is become the stats guy on TV for the COVID-19 pandemic.
Hi there, Casey. You've got all the figures for us, but let's start with Victoria.
Yes, New South Wales is good, but let's start with Victoria.
Casey Briggs breaks down COVID-19 data for viewers of the ABC.
It's a rapid escalation. It's almost five times higher than the number of infections found on the same day last week in the state.
Casey brings a unique skill set to his work in the media. He didn't study journalism at uni. Instead, he completed a Master of Philosophy in Mathematics and Statistics at the University of Adelaide. But rather than stick with maths and stats, he decided to pursue a career in the media.
Mathematics education in lots of ways means you see the world in a slightly different way to someone that studied journalism. I think about things. I have that sort of logical training that mathematics gives you.
Then 2020 arrived, and within a few months, a global pandemic set in. Casey's unique skill was needed more than ever. In this episode, Casey talks about his role in communicating data, especially when it comes to a story like the COVID-19 pandemic.
Consumers of news, people that are watching the news, have a whole new renewed appetite for data, I think in a way that hasn't existed much, certainly not to this level in the past.
And he talks about the challenges of presenting statistics and data to a TV audience.
In television news particularly, where you have not very long often to communicate some quite complicated ideas and you've got one shot at getting it through and getting it understood correctly.
This week's guest, Casey Briggs from the ABC. Welcome to The Random Sample, a podcast by the Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence for Mathematical and Statistical Frontiers. I'm Emily Duane. In this show, we share stories about mathematics, statistics, and the people involved. You can learn more about what the centre does by visiting our website, acems.org.au. That's acems.org.au. Our host for this episode is ACEMS Communications and Media Officer Tim McCugar.
Hello, I'm Tim McCugar. I'm the ACEMS Media and Communications Officer. Before I was with ACEMS, I spent nearly 30 years in television news in the United States, various producing and managerial roles, and now I am immersing myself in the maths and stats community here in Australia. I'm joined by a man, though, who's done the opposite in a way. He's studied mathematics, got a master's in mathematics at the University of Adelaide, and is now in the media with the ABC. Casey Briggs, welcome to the Random Sample.
Hi, Tim. Good to be with you.
Casey, there are so many things I want to talk to you about, but as a former journalist, I've been trained to not bury the lead. I want to get right to the lead here and get to 2020 before we get into your background. So in 2020, obviously, the big story has been the pandemic. It's been an extraordinary time for not only the world, but really your career. How did you really become the stats guy for the ABC and the pandemic?
Yeah, I think we really have to sort of backtrack back to February and March as this whole thing was kicking off around the world. And I think it's easy for us now to remember just how fast moving the news was, how quickly things were changing, how much we were learning about this virus, really, you know, sort of multiple times a day things were changing, and there was just a lot of confusion in the world. But one thing was certain, and that was that data is really the way that we will understand how this story plays out in Australia and around the world. You know, in order to, you know, understand the spread of a pandemic and how we can slow it down, you know, for long enough to develop treatments and vaccines and the like, well, we need to have a really good grasp of the data that's out there. The other thing that was clear was that there was a lot of it, and it was of variable quality. Sometimes it was from various sources, and it was really quite confusing. So that was the environment that we sort of found ourselves in March. And we were sort of talking about how can we best present and bring people the latest in graphics, in the latest in the data, so that they can understand exactly what's going on. Audiences can understand exactly what's going on in the world. And, you know, a lot of the TV sort of news processes aren't really set up for dealing with data that changes so regularly. You know, getting graphics through TV graphics departments takes time. And so we were really starting to think about, okay, are there interactive ways that we can do this? And obviously the ABC has a little bit of experience with interactive touchscreens through our work on covering elections and our chief election analyst, Anthony Green's work on election night with his magic touchscreen. So we thought, is there a way we can take a similar sort of approach with this data? So we sort of moved into what was, we could see this void of information, this confusion, really kind of across the entire country as states and territories and governments were updating figures constantly, you know, sometimes multiple times a day as we were getting a grasp of things. We really kicked ourselves into gear and worked, not just me, a team of a few people, including our graphics specialist, Ryan Curlin, who wrote the software that I use every day. He got a first sort of prototype version up and running within about a week and a half or so that we got to air as quickly as we could. And we've just been finessing it ever since. And really it was a way of synthesizing data from a lot of sources. You know, we're pulling in data from, you know, something like a dozen sources of information plus others that come to hand from time to time, getting that into a consistent format, synthesizing it and using that to give some analysis of where things are at. And, you know, back in March and April, as I say, it was changing constantly. And so it was, you know, something that was, you know, really sorely needed and really, I think, appreciated by people who could just come to one place to learn everything they needed to know that day or even that hour about what was going on.
As you mentioned, there's a boatload of data. How do you choose from all that data? How do you decide what's the most relevant for that day or that particular newscast?
Yeah, what we found in Australia as well is that while states, governments might use similar names for things, they don't always mean they're talking about the same things. So there's been a lot of work in just understanding, you know, how states, how governments define things and how we can then compare and make comparisons that make some amount of sense in presenting that. So we are pulling in information from each state and territory. They each present their data in different ways. They store it in different ways. They release it in different ways. So it is, and it has changed a lot through the pandemic. So there's a lot of data, manual data entry involved in that. We supplement it with information from the Federal Health Department that gives us a bit more of an idea about where infections are coming from, where infections are being found, and also information around, you know, some particular environments like aged care and the like, in a way that mean we can more easily compare figures across states. So that's sort of where we get the bulk of our Australian information from. And then overseas, a multitude of sources. We've been using the team at Johns Hopkins University have done a pretty phenomenal job, both balancing accuracy and making sure that those figures are not just up to date, but also corrected when they're incorrect, and also timeliness of updating. There are a lot of different sources of data around the world. So it has been using that collected group that they are publishing and inviting people to use has been one source, but also then going back to original primary sources of information from governments around the world to cross-reference, to check, and to get a bit deeper on certain issues. And then as well as that, you know, the multitude of other pieces of information that help us explain the world, not just from a health perspective, but, you know, what is happening with employment and this pandemic-induced recession that we're seeing, what's happening with other health information, you know, other diseases, other notifiable conditions in Australia. How are we responding as people? How are we moving and mixing with other people? So transport and mobility information as well, pulling that all in to the, you know, the databases that our software reads. It's been, you know, quite a big job to stay across all of that.
It sounds like, at least initially, one of the biggest challenge is deciding which data you could trust, right?
It really was. And, you know, we even see that now sometimes where we hear terminology like mystery cases, community transmission, local transmission, and different states regard those things as meaning different things. Community transmission in particular, the New South Wales Premier uses that term in one way, the Victorian Premier, many of the other states use it in a completely different way. So there is a bit of an element of us making sure not just that we faithfully, record what states are reporting, but that we truly understand it. And that trust issue has been a big one, and it's been a big issue around the world as well. Different governments reporting information in different ways, with holding information in some cases in different ways, using different terminology, makes for a very confusing picture. And, it's confusing for me, so it would be, and I'm looking at it day in and day out. So I think for most people, watching the news, tuning in each night, it would be, thoroughly bamboozling, working out what data to trust, and also sort of doing some of that education of the people that are watching us so that they can, make better informed decisions about the sources of information they trust. That's been a really big part of this project.
Absolutely. I want to get back to that education part in just a little bit, but when you're dealing with data, obviously from television, you have to make it visually interesting and well. So essentially you're doing a different exercise in data visualization every day. Can you talk about that? How to best show off this data to the viewer and how challenging that is.
And you would know, Tim, just how difficult it can be in television news, particularly where you have not very long often to communicate some quite complicated ideas, and you've got one shot at getting it through and getting it understood correctly, because most people are not, sitting and watching back over and over again. You've got that 90 seconds sometimes just to make clear exactly what you're saying. The good thing we've had this year, the lucky thing, I guess, is that consumers of news, people that are watching the news, have a whole new renewed appetite for data, I think, in a way that hasn't existed much, certainly not to this level in the past. And so people want to know about this. People understand that the best way of understanding how this pandemic is unfolding is through data. And so there is that appetite and that willingness of people to go along with you. But for me, it's been really a matter of just thinking through very clearly what is the information that gives, what are the small number of statistics, charts, graphs that give you a clear understanding of what's going on, a representative understanding. We're not misleading people, but we're also not overwhelming people with more information than they could possibly take in. Because if you, were to try and absorb every single piece of information, you'd be driven crazy pretty quickly. So that has been, one of the challenges that we've had. It's just working out, what it is. And then really once, the touchscreen is actually very simple, technology, frankly. We have, ways of displaying individual summary statistics, individual line charts and trends over time, and bar charts. That's really all it comes down to. And we can combine them in various ways, but it's not all that complicated. It's really about picking what is the key information here when there's so many statistics out there. And that emphasis changes from time to time as we move through different phases of this pandemic. And the quality of that data is also kind of changes from time to time. When Victoria was going through its second wave of infections and at the peak of that, the quality of the contact tracing data and the sort of source of transmission data that we were seeing was pretty low, because, we saw thousands of cases that were, a backlog of thousands of cases that were being investigated, in some cases for not just a couple of days, not just a week, but even longer. And that meant that, we couldn't really draw many conclusions out of the source of transmission information that was being published, because we just didn't know anything about the infections that were still being investigated. And so you really needed to work out, how we can best understand what's going on without inadvertently misleading people. That goes back to that trust question. What information can you trust, and how reliable can you regard it as being, and what best tells the story at that point in time?
Okay, which brings us to the education part of this. I think all of us it's been a learning experience for all of us. It's clearly been a learning experience for politicians, for, your colleagues as journalists, for people like me. We've really been exposed to a lot of mathematical concepts over this past year, haven't we?
Absolutely. If I, I I hadn't thought when I became a journalist that I would be spending quite so long explaining, you know, logarithmic scales and second derivatives and all those sorts of concepts to a live television audience. And the trick has been really to, you know, not dwell on the mathematical language, but really get to the heart of what the point of what we're trying to say is, and the point of, you know, why we're presenting data in a certain way and what it tells us. You know, the other challenge has been all that data that we're using is freely available, publicly available information. And when there's so much information, it can be very easy for narratives to be spun by cherry picking individual figures, by individual countries, by looking at, you know, certain scenarios, but excluding all other evidence. And part of the challenge has been countering some of that, what becomes, in some cases, very convincing looking misinformation around the way that this pandemic, this virus operates and this pandemic has spread. That has been, you know, a challenge. And, you know, the more information that's out in the public domain, the better. But sometimes the way that can be presented can be, you know, very misleading.
Absolutely. Has that been one of the biggest challenges you've faced dealing with, you know, in the context of having to present all this data to make sure that people aren't spinning it like they shouldn't?
Yeah, and it's also one of the challenges I have, you know, writing, you know, presenting this information daily, making sure that I'm not inadvertently spinning an incorrect interpretation. You know, even if it's not something I'm saying, maybe it's a thing I've left unsaid that can, you know, be inadvertently misinterpreted. So, you know, there is a lot of room for error here, I guess. And what we have seen, I guess, though, is, you know, news organizations, ABC News, but all news organizations have seen a really big spike in traffic and audiences, particularly through that early period of the pandemic when everything was very confusing. We have seen audiences, you know, at you know, levels we're not used to seeing, and I think that demonstrates that people are coming to trusted sources of information. There will always be people willfully distorting information. I think it's a minority of people, but, you know, they can be dangerous if that kind of thinking can be dangerous if it's unchecked. You know, I've been lucky. People have been have responded to, you know, what I've been doing in such a good way that, you know, what I'm saying is generally trusted, but that, of course, puts the pressure on me to, you know, make sure I'm not making any mistakes. And, you know, the last thing I'd want to do is mislead anyone.
What have you learned? I mean, communicating statistics and data can be a bit challenging. I know that. I do that for a living, and I'm not necessarily always trying to reach a mainstream audience. You are. I mean, talk about that challenge. What have you learned through this process?
I mean, I think we've learned a lot that people reading and watching the news, that the appetite is there if data is presented, if statistics are presented in a, you know, digestible way, in an intelligent way, the audience is there for it. You know, we shouldn't be shying away from it in a way that I think newsrooms sometimes do, in an effort at simplifying stories, in an effort at, you know, making that 90-second TV news package as simple and punchy as possible. Sometimes, you know, the data that underpins things can be left by the wayside. And what we've learned this year is really some techniques for presenting, you know, presenting it in a way that is punchy and sharp, but is also intelligent and leaves room for the uncertainty and the doubt that exists in all data and all statistics, and really makes sure that people understand that uncertainty and that doubt. That has been a big part of what we've been doing this year, is not just saying how many infections there are in each state each day, but also how much doubt there is and how much uncertainty there is in all of the data that we've been working with. So it's not just been presenting information on the touchscreen software that we use every day. We've learned a lot about TV news graphics. We've learned a lot about how we present this sort of information in prepackaged form in a way that, you know, is interesting, is engaging, and is still correct and is still in the right context. And that is one of the issues I think news sometimes struggles with. But the appetite, the audience is absolutely there. That's what we've learned.
That's good to hear. Now, you mentioned uncertainty and that you're communicating it, but that's still a difficult thing to communicate, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, we know humans are not great at interpreting probability. You know, humans are not when we talk about, you know, a lot of the modeling around this virus in Australia has talked about, you know, probability chances that you know, Melbourne will need to go back into lockdown, or that this virus will surge in other parts of the country. And there's a lot of, you know, what we're talking about in some of those situations is a catastrophic outcome, you know, is a catastrophic outcome around, you know, city lockdowns and the economic pain that that will inflict on a city, but also the health consequences if this virus surges again. And some of that remains difficult. It's human nature to not, you know, think about those sorts of probabilities and to discount, you know, things with a small chance of happening, even if they have a really catastrophic consequence. That you know, obviously remains a challenge. And also communicating that modeling in that modeling is itself uncertain. All models are wrong, you know, all models are incorrect, and it's about finding the useful models that can tell us something about the world and understanding how much certainty we can have in that. That has been a challenge. That's never not going to be a challenge that we need to grapple with. But you know, again, I think we've seen some of that fear of uncertainty dissipate a little bit this year. We've seen an acceptance that, you know, things are uncertain and the world is never black and white. That has happened a little bit this year, and it's our challenge, I guess, as journalists to, you know, make sure that, you know, we understand that there's uncertainty in mathematical modelling in of a pandemic, in, you know, there's mathematical modelling of the way this virus spreads, but that applies to all scenarios and all worlds in which we use data.
That's great, and which helps us transition into the next part of one I want to get into, which is your background, your education at the University of Adelaide. Now, before we get into that, you did your studies surrounded by groups of people who do mathematic modeling for, you know, they've been doing it for years, studying epidemics for a year. How has that being around some of that group at Adelaide helped you even more than just having a math background, but having know that there's this modeling going on with epidemics, with pandemics, and exposed you to that, to that information? How's that helped you?
Yeah, I must say, Tim, when I did an honors course in mathematical epidemiology while I was a student, I thought at the time, this is a vaguely interesting topic that I, you know, might not come back to ever again. Who would have thought that it would become so useful? It's certainly been a useful, you know, bit of background knowledge, even coming into this pandemic in January as we were first sort of learning about it. And, you know, just having that that understanding of what R naught and the reproduction number, you know, is and what it means from the very beginning has, I think, helped me quite substantially. So having that background information, I think, is, you know, I could jump straight into this and become that sort of conduit between, you know, with one foot in a mathematical world and one foot in a journalism world, turning that, you know, quite complicated modeling in some cases and, you know, simulation-based, stochastic modeling-based sort of work into language that journalists can understand. You know, having that academic community around you is obviously, you know, really important. And you know, I don't think I'd be able to do what I'm doing without having that.
All right, so take us back to Adelaide. You know, what did you initially start with at Adelaide? Were you all, you studied mathematics, but, you know, how did that mathematics turn into media? Can you talk about your journey through the university?
Yeah, so I think the first program I enrolled in at the University of Adelaide was actually, I think, an engineering degree, a computational engineering degree. And I very, very, very quickly realized that maybe that's not quite what I wanted to do. And I flipped to just a Bachelor of Mathematical and Computer Sciences and studied a little bit of computer science, but really focused more on the mathematics side of things, and progressed through my sort of undergraduate life, focusing really less on statistics than the other sort of disciplines that were sort of on offer, more around optimization and probability and those optimization and sort of the pure mathematics sort of world. And then moved into, finished my undergraduate degree. Wasn't entirely sure what I would want to do with my life, but beyond that, had sort of started doing a little bit of sort of student media work while I was at university. I was a volunteer in our student radio programs. I'd started writing for the student paper from time to time. And while I was still working out what on earth I was going to do with the rest of my life, I enrolled in a Master of Philosophy, studying statistics, studying applied maths. And that was sort of where I started really more of an interest in statistics. It hadn't really been something I'd focused on. It was not the courses at uni that I was performing most strongly in, but it was what I ended up finding myself doing in a master's project. And really from there, kind of reached the end of that, having then also sort of sidelined as a student paper editor and a few other things, and, had to decide, what comes next. And I just sort of felt while I really valued my academic experience and I really enjoyed the academic experience, it probably wasn't something that I was keen to kind of continue at that time in a full-time sort of way, and go on to do a doctorate and into that world. It just didn't feel quite right to me. I think the pace of research was maybe something that I struggled a little bit with. I'm a little bit more fast moving. I like to make things, and sort of sometimes the pace of science can be a little bit slower. So I just decided, why don't I try out this other thing I've been doing on the side, try it out and see where we go. And I got a cadetship at the ABC, where I really learned to become a journalist. And that was not a mathematics job. That was me really learning how do you get out there and cover, all sorts of stories around the place, and learned to become a journalist. And then just in the last couple of years, I've really been trying to bring those two worlds together, because there is, a gap in the journalism industry for people who work with data, for people who have a scientific background. And so I thought it would be useful for the industry, useful for audiences, if I could bring some of that research sort of skill and bring that sort of link back to mathematics, statistics and the academic world back into journalism.
So what were the job interviews like? They're looking at your resume, seeing you have a master's in mathematics.
I think because I had, 7 years of community radio experience under my belt as well, because I've done that all through my university life, I think the fact that I didn't have a journalism degree was less of an issue than it could have been. I came through a cadetship program where they, were looking for people with other life experience as well. So that helped. That certainly meant that, I certainly had a more distinctive, I think, resume than maybe many other applicants. If I'd just been coming in with only a mathematics degree, well, yeah, I think that, I might have been thrown in the trash heap, but that other experience really was, I think, one of the things that got me over the line. So the mathematics was a point of difference that in the end helped. Certainly the interviews were a little bit different. They were a little bit bemused by me, but it all panned out in the end.
So where was that cadetship, and where did you go from there? Kind of take us through your journey to where you are now, which is in Sydney, right?
Yeah, so the cadetship, the way the ABC cadetships work is you apply for it and they will just send you somewhere. So it is very much you get thrown in the deep end. So I got sent to Brisbane as the Brisbane cadet, and that was when I moved to Queensland. And really that is a really good training year in the fundamentals of journalism that's useful for anyone, I think, regardless of whether they've actually studied it or not. But it was particularly useful for me, where you just get thrown into all sorts of scenarios, covered a bit of courts, covered a bit of, general news and, crime scenes and all that kind of you know, police round type stuff. You cover natural disasters, you cover a bit of politics, you just do a bit of everything across sort of all platforms of the ABC. And I spent a year in Brisbane, and then they sent me out to regional Australia, and I worked in Cairns for about a year and a half, again, covering all of the news that is around in far north Queensland, which it turns out is quite a lot going on in that patch in that part of the world, where I just really, you know, again, learned how to be a journalist and cut my teeth doing the sort of fundamentals of journalism. And after that, I moved back to Adelaide, back home, where I joined the Adelaide newsroom and eventually became a state political reporter, which was also has also been an interest of mine. And, you know, my master's thesis, my master's research project was had a lot of intersections with the world of politics as well. So started to, you know, get back into, you know, more of a world that I was had some background knowledge in, and then spent another year and a half there or so. And then I just moved to Sydney this year on a sort of development program with the ABC called the Andrew Ollie Scholarship, which is this fantastic opportunity I was given to really expose myself to other parts of the ABC and learn from some of the best in the organization, some really high level skills. And then, as we know, a couple of months into my time in Sydney, the pandemic hit, and sort of the way we work got turned completely on its head. And that's when we developed this this project that I've spent really the rest of the year on in covering the pandemic. So I sort of, in some ways, lucked out and happened to be in Sydney when this happened, and was able to, you know, take the chance to try something new that we've not tried before at the ABC. And it, you know, obviously it's paid off, and we're still doing it, you know, all these months later.
Is there anything about your maths and stats background that has stood out, you know, other than this year? I mean, has any, before we got to this year, and we clearly see where the maths and stats is helping your career, but is there anything about it that helped you before that as you moved through your new career in the media?
I think, I mean, you know, there are always stories involving data and statistics around the place that a lot of journalists either don't see or avoid. And so I've, you know, definitely made an effort to try and bring that in wherever I can use, you know, have used tools like Freedom of Information and the like to get, you know, data sets out of government that can tell us more about, you know, the policy decisions that governments make and the way that governments make decisions about, you know, projects around cities and the country. So there's that. But also, I think, you know, having that mathematics education in lots of ways means you see the world in a slightly different way to someone that studied journalism. I think about things. I have that sort of logical training that mathematics gives you in a way that helps you make linkages and see patterns between things in slightly different ways. So I've found that sort of logical reasoning and thinking really useful in covering politics, because you start to see those patterns that arise. And, you know, most of what, you know, at its core, what is mathematics but sort of, you know, pattern finding and that sort of reasoning. So it has been useful in many ways. It is not, you know, not the kind of training that you think would make you a good journalist, but in lots of ways, those research skills are wholly transferable.
Okay, so now let's move forward. It's assuming we all get through COVID and that there's some type of world past it. I mean, what do you hope to do moving forward? Is politics something that you really want to get back into?
Look, without telegraphing every single thing I'm working on, there are lots of opportunities for, I think, data and statistics to be better brought into the way we do journalism. So that can be in politics, and that can be in, you know, the way that, you know, we understand politics and politicians, you know, the sports frauds saga that, you know, I think many people have forgotten about because it happened just before the bushfires and the pandemic. But that issue with, you know, the way that grants are allocated was a story that really only made sense once you had that data. And so that's a story that data can, you know, help with. And the way we visualize those sorts of things, we're sort of interested in exploring. But there's, you know, other things. There's lots of data around, you know, the way our climate is changing and the way bushfires affect our environment, and the way that you know, our energy grid and the way that energy policies will work. That is an area that I think that, you know, there is a wealth of data that journalism has not exploited yet. So I think there's lots of ways we can take the work that we've done this year and you know, look at other ways of look at applying it to other sorts of stories. There's certainly no let's just say when the pandemic is over, I don't think I'll be bored.
Absolutely not. May I talk a little politics with you right now, as far as, you know, because, you know, in the last 4 years, we've seen a U.S. election where the polls showed that Donald Trump wouldn't become president. And last year here in Australia, it didn't look like Scott Morrison was going to stay the prime minister. You know, the polls seemed to all get it wrong. Is there anything that stood out to you about polling surveys and where you think things may have been misinterpreted or not understood properly, and why the results came out like they did?
I think, I mean, one of the things you've just said, the polls got it wrong, is a statement that's sort of taken as fact at the moment. When we know that polls are just estimates, and they have a margin of error, and they have a you know, there is, you know, all sorts of issues that need to be taken account of, sampling bias and sample size and, you know, the representativeness of the population that you're looking at. And yeah, the polls in the 2016 presidential election, the less likely option, according to the polls, occurred, but, you know, it still had a chance of occurring. And so the more that we can stop thinking of things like that as, you know, completely binary outcomes, you know, either the polls are right or the polls are wrong, well, the better off in many ways we'll be. And of course, you know, when polls are wrong but it doesn't change the outcome of an election, no one really cares, even if the polls were 10 points out but the right, you know, but instead of a slim majority then a vast majority actually was the outcome, well, the polls are still wrong, and in fact they're arguably more wrong in that case than they were in the 2016 presidential election. So, you know, if there's anything that I wish we could do more of, it's embracing uncertainty and embracing doubt in the work that we do and the work that we forecast. I work on our election night coverage. I've done that for a few years now with the ABC. And, you know, one of the principles that we go in with as, you know, people analysing the results that are coming in is there's uncertainty. And what we're doing is giving estimates. We're in many ways calculating probabilities of, you know, certain outcomes and making projections based on that. And you know, that can be hard to explain to people sometimes, that, you know, we're not calling individual seats necessarily all the time, you know, in an election on election night. What we're talking about is, you know, probabilistic outcomes based on figures that we've seen, how they compare to previous elections, and what we can expect will be the final results. So uncertainty and doubt is a common thread through this pandemic. It's a common thread through all data, and it's something that I wish we would embrace more.
And it really comes back to being more statistically literate. I mean, it's a challenge for all of us. It's becoming clear, I think, to a lot of people that having some type of statistical knowledge, some type of statistical background is becoming more and more useful. I mean,
and it's a huge challenge for journalism because, as I said, we've got 90 seconds sometimes to tell a story. And if I were to, you know, spend 45 seconds of my 90 seconds on a politics story talking about all the ways that we're not sure about this, well, you know, my editor would be a bit unhappy with me, and audience would probably be pretty unhappy with me, because you just don't have that much time. So it's a real challenge to, you know, find the best ways of explaining those concepts, making it clear what we don't know, you know, what we know and what we don't know, in a way that's still engaging and isn't, you know, isn't requiring everyone to have a statistics degree at the same time.
Great. I think that's a really good message to end on, so we'll stop there. Casey, thanks so much for taking time to join the Random Sample. Really enjoyed our chat. You're doing the maths and stats community proud by bringing your expertise to the media. So keep up the great work, and really the best of luck for you as you move forward in your career.
Thanks, Tim. It's good to chat.
You can also find Casey Briggs on Twitter at Casey Briggs. You can find Tim McHugh on Twitter at CLE in BNE. There is some bonus material from Tim's chat with Casey Briggs on the ASIMS webpage for this episode. Casey talks about his work with the ABC's election guru, Anthony Green.
He's the expert, and I'm sort of always a bit in awe at the way he can turn a flood of information into not just determining outcomes with remarkable accuracy, remarkably quickly, but turn that into a really clear story of what's going on around, you know, the particular election.
To listen to that, head to asims.org.au/podcast and click on episode 36. Then, coming up in our next episode of The Random Sample.
When you're chatting to someone and you say, I do computational statistics, and you see their eyes light up because they know what you're talking about, you're like, oh, we're about to nerd out together. And it's a great time.
We catch up with four maths and stats students in various stages of their career through uni. How did they come to study maths and stats? What's it been like? And why they all believe it's something that will lead to bright futures and careers for them. That's coming up on our next episode of The Random Sample. Thank you for listening to The Random Sample, a podcast brought to you by the Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence for Mathematical and Statistical Frontiers. If you like what you heard, please rate us on iTunes, because we think stories about maths and stats are worth sharing, and we want others to discover that as well. You can learn more about what we do at asims.org.au. That's acems.org.au. And you can find us on social media by searching at acemathstats. That's at acemathstats. We'll see you next week with another story from within ASIMS. Bye for now.